Today, I welcome as my guest Shyam Ranganathan. And Shyam is a professor at York University, and he's a faculty of liberal arts and professional studies. And he specializes in ethics, political philosophy, moral philosophy, specifically from the angle of Asian philosophy and Indian philosophy. But obviously, he's very well versed in European philosophy and all sorts of moral and political and ethical dilemmas that we as human beings had to look at to ensure the safety of all people. So I've asked Shyam to come and talk about a very delicate topic, and I would love for you to make sure that you are well supported if you're going to listen to this, meaning you have time and space to digest and process and be with yourself, maybe be with loved ones who you can have courageous conversations with afterwards or during. Maybe you just want to listen to a few parts of it at a time and just take it in little chunks. We are talking today about the moral, ethical, and political ramifications of what's happening in Israel and has happened in Gaza. This is my small offering of trying to work through this for myself, which in turn may stimulate some of you to work through it within yourself. As you'll see, the first half of the interview is kind of setting up the moral philosophy of who are we, why are we here, and what does it mean to be pro-person, meaning I want goodness for all people on earth. I want water for all people on earth. I want safety for all people. I want food for all people. You know, tying that idea into me as a person who also wants goodness and water and food and safety, those two things are not disconnected. They do come together. And so the first half of the interview is just kind of setting that up, and then stay with it because the second half of the interview is all about applying that to the Israeli and Palestinian war that's going on right now and the genocide that's happening right now. So I hope that you can take this in. I know it's a challenging thing to listen to and to think about and to decide for yourself what it means to have sovereignty. So, all right, let's go ahead and get started with Shyam. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 7. We are so happy that you've been here on the journey with us for almost 2 years now, and we're looking at over 130,000 downloads. It has been a wonderful run together, and we are going to continue to provide excellent content. And this season, we want to go into the depths of the human experience and the human heart. So stay tuned. We're going to continue this journey together, and we look forward to seeing you for all of season 7. Welcome, Shyam. Thank you so much for taking the opportunity to discuss something a little difficult today. I'm having a little fear about our conversation, but I also trust that you will be able to hold the conversation. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having.
So first, I want to say that I saw you on a Facebook post talking about the conflict of Israel and Gaza, the Israeli government and Hamas. And I thought, wow, we need someone who has the goods to walk us through how we as yogis can look at this. But I think we first should acknowledge that you've just written a book that basically outlines how we can work through really difficult things like this. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Right. In April, Yoga Anti-Colonial Philosophy came out. And so it's written for yoga practitioners, anybody interested in yoga and or philosophy. You can use it in a YTT as your like yoga humanities book. It covers all the texts that you should be familiar with.
Can we name some of those briefly?
Yeah, sure. So you go back to the Upanishads, the Yoga Sutra, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. That's just the yoga tradition. But also, I think it's really important to distinguish yoga from other South Asian traditions that usually get mushed up together, like Buddhism, Jainism, Vedanta, Sankhya. There's a whole world of philosophy in South Asian. Yoga is just one option. I love yoga because it's the philosophy of options, of choosing. Of making options clear so that you can choose autonomously. It's a very important part of the practice. And so then understanding yoga is really, in many ways, understanding how it's different from all sorts of other options you could choose. And I think we need to have that conversation because, in colonialism is all about not being given options, having only one choice imposed upon you. And so yoga is really large. The practice makes colonialism very difficult. It's like the resistance.
And when you say colonialism, are you talking about what happened to India when the colonialists came? Are you just talking about a way of looking at the world being in a colonialist mindset or both?
Both. So, colonizers, we're on Turtle Island, you and me, right? So, where we live has a history of genocide, settler colonialism. Settler colonialism is one version of colonialism that tries to get rid of the native population. Then there's another version called, well, you could call it exploitative colonialism, where you keep the population, but then they're subordinated to, enslaved in some way. That happened in India. So India was an exercise of exploitative colonialism. This often happens when the colonizer, like they're outnumbered. There's too many, but there's also value in it in subordinating a population. You can extract value and labor from them for cheap or for free. The British basically got it for free. Super sneaky. They taxed Indians and then they bought products, Indian products, with the money they took from Indians as taxation and then sold those through London. So they basically like extracted, like it was something on the order of $45 trillion. Like that's a huge number. I have it in the book. But colonialism presents these opportunities for an oppressor to take over, but it works because there's no resistance, right? And resisting isn't easy. But colonialism is also not easy. So, like, insofar as oppression really is trying to take away our freedom, I think if you appreciate that, then if you value your freedom, then you think, well, I have to resist because if I don't, I'm giving in to oppression. So, there's a kind of the external phenomenon of colonialism as an imposition. But then there's also the way that we either accommodated or resisted. And that's a personal moral and political choice. And so one of the points I make in the book is that yoga is the basic practice of yoga is devotion to Ishvara or sovereignty. And then you practice the essential traits of Ishvara, which is tapas, unconservatism, and swadhyaya, self-governance. And if you're doing that, you can't be colonized because colonization is trying to take away your independence. And meanwhile, you're practicing independence. So that's why I call yoga anti-colonial philosophy. At its very base, it's not friendly to colonialism, but the point that it teaches us is that if we don't practice this, we are allowing ourselves to be colonized. Because what happens is then we just start to accommodate all these external pressures and expectations for us to conform. So unless we're explicitly valuing sovereignty, we end up just following along, which is why we wake up and all of a sudden there's all this injustice and oppression. And then we wonder, how did we get here? And we got here because, on the whole, people weren't concerned with their own independence, right? They were just kind of willing to go along because they thought it made life easier in some way.
So, I mean, we could have a whole podcast on, being sovereign and basically bowing within yourself to Ishvara. And I want to define Ishvara. I know you just said tapas svadhyaya, and I suspect Ishvara pranidhana. Can you just pull that apart a little bit more?
Yeah.
Because when I talk to people about your post on Facebook, they said, "What is Ishvara again?" Can we just pull that apart
Yeah,
a little
sure.
bit?
So I think it's the basic value of yoga. So Ishvara is the ideal of right choosing and doing. So it's a procedural idea. It's different from theistic God. So the theist God is good. It's a kind of outcome. The Ishvara of yoga is a way of doing things. It's a procedure. And it's not that Ishvara is not real. It is personal, but it's the ideal of what it is to be a person. And then if you look at book one of the Yoga Sutra, Sutra 22, something, I'm bad with numbers around there, potentially defines Ishvara in terms of two groups of traits. It doesn't have baggage. It's not constrained by its past choices. So it's free to do something new. So it's unconservative. But then it's also not externally limited. It's not afflicted. So there's nothing stopping its choices going forward. So it's able to self-determine. Swadhyaya. So that's kind of the basic idea. It's already there. And then when we look at the start of book two, potentially defines yoga as a kriya, which is an activity. And then he says it's three kriyas. It's devotion to Ishvara. And then you practice the essential traits of Ishvara, of tapas, and so of self-challenge and conservatism, swadhyaya, self-governance. So if you don't understand what Ishvara is, this seems like a really arbitrary list. Like, why are we doing this, right? And what am I devoted to? But when you go back and you take a look at it's a very specific definition, what potentially is saying is that like the devotion to this ideal is practicing its essential traits yourself. So when we're devoted to Ishvara, we're not claiming to be sovereign. It's aspirational. Because it's aspirational, we don't give up the work. We don't ever sit back and go, oh, I'm sovereign. We're always devoted to Ishvara, but then we're always engaged in the practices of being independent. And that's why in the Yoga Sutra potentially says when you've succeeded in yoga, you're in a state of autonomy, kaivalya. He doesn't say we're sovereign. He said that we're autonomous. That means that we're in charge of our life, that our life is best described in terms of our choices, not external pressure.
Even though there may be structural and systemic
Right. So
really
that's the catch
challenging
about autonomy.
difficulties.
It doesn't mean everything is autonomous. You're autonomous. So there can still be lots of systemic oppression. There can be lots of people who are oppressing, but you're not participating in that insofar as your choices and activities are autonomous, not a matter of external pressure. So, Kaivalya can be a very ordinary state, but it's a state where there's no way to understand their choices or what they're doing without just really taking them seriously as someone who's choosing and doing. And then I think there's pretty much everybody else where they just fall into line. They're doing kind of what's expected or what they feel like they have to, otherwise they'll get into trouble, right? So the fear to talk about, like I've also had that very real concern because like people get fired. We've seen all sorts of wild repercussions that people have suffered because they've spoken out. So working on this doesn't mean you're foolhardy. So you could still appreciate that things are dangerous, but you still make these choices in ways that you can manage. You're not just going along. And ultimately, it's really about this self-care because like oppression doesn't care about you. So you might think for a little while, oh, I shouldn't stand up to it because I'll get hurt, but you're going to get hurt anyways. Like oppression doesn't care about you. So if you don't make this a priority, you will definitely, one way or another, suffer the
Now or later.
consequences. Yeah,
Yeah.
right. So maybe not in this specific instance, you might be able to get away with it, but it'll have repercussions in your life.
And could we say fundamentally that the philosophy of yoga happens in society? It happens in community where, like, it's assumed we're going to care about each other and not be individualistic and only care about ourselves? Or is that not true?
Yeah, so when you look at the beginning of the South Asian tradition, so community wasn't really a basic concern because they didn't think about people as humans defined by their human connections with others in community. That's a very kind of Greek thing. And it goes back to thinking about language as essential to thinking. This is also very Greek. And so when the Western tradition is developing, it theorizes people as language users in specific linguistic communities. And that's actually the origins of a lot of the problems we're seeing now, where people think that, well, what it is to be a person in this linguistic community. So then I don't have to really worry about people outside of my community, right? So an ethno-linguistic state that prioritizes itself will, of course, not care about people who aren't part of their community. And so that's a huge part of the way settler colonialism works. it actually views people outside of the community as a threat, because what it is to be a person is defined by these communal relationships of language. And so then if there are people who basically showed you you don't need that because you can do it differently, they're then viewed as a threat. And so genocide ends up being a consequence of this, right? So I'm writing another book on colonialism, and I have a chapter on genocide. And it occurred to me that, like, in every case where you can identify a case of genocide, the people engaged in genocide have a strong ethno-linguistic identity, and the people they're wiping out frequently have a different ethno-linguistic identity. And the people, you know, who are being wiped are treated as somehow kind of very dangerous, and you can't work with them. When we go back to ancient South Asia, it didn't start with that basic assumption. And so individuality wasn't a threat to care for others. Like, there wasn't this kind of opposition. In fact, when you look at yoga, the idea is that if you're not a responsible individual, you can't enter into responsible relationships with other people. So you have to really work on being an individual in order to have healthy relationships. And there's no one else that's going to be the leader. You have to take the lead, right? So that means often breaking cultural norms and expectations that people have gotten used to but are oppressive. And that can seem like, oh, that person is being individualistic. But what in the yoga practice they're doing is they're resetting boundaries to allow for healthy interaction. So yoga then begins with kind of this insight: we have to engage in disruptive activity. You know, protest, and also just kind of activity that disrupts systemic oppressive practices. So in a way, it'll seem very anti-community, right, at first, and it'll seem like, but because the yogi is devoted to Ishvara, they're interested in something we share. All of us have an interest in Ishvara. So the more they're devoted to Ishvara, the more they act in ways that are actually in the interests of everybody. But it is disruptive.
Yeah, I love how you explain that, because I think sometimes the philosophy gets used to say, oh, being individualistic is selfish and you're not.
Right.
You
That's
know,
right.
Instead
yeah.
of, no, I'm becoming a healthy individual because I care about the other.
Yeah, in fact, you can't really care about others unless you have boundaries, right? What is this other if I don't have a boundary? It's just an extension of myself, which people talk that way. I find it very disturbing. They think they're being loving or romantic, but like, it's weird. I'm not an extension of you. I'm a separate person. If you can't appreciate that, you're just not going to value me or love me in ways that I deserve to be regarded. I'm just going to be seen as an extension of your projects. So, you know, I think it's the condition of actual responsible, caring relationships are these boundaries. And so once you start to rectify them, you're able then to value other people.
Right. And so that's what you mean when you speak of being pro-human, yes?
Well, pro-person, right? For instance, in English, we have this very common way of talking about people and animals, and people means human. So that, I think, comes just from this prioritization of language as part of identity. You know, Aristotle calls animals with the logos principle. So one way, logos was their word for speech and logic. And one way to read that is that, well, humans are rational animals, but it also meant in the Greek that humans are the animals that can speak, right?
Wow.
Basically meant that too. And so very early in the Western tradition, we get this dichotomy set up between humans and then the rest of the world. And then this weird lie, we're not animals, right? We tell ourselves this story. It's not true. Biologically, it's just not true. I think just in that previous conversation, when you look at the way colonialism and genocide works, where linguistic identity becomes part of the sense of who you are, this way of thinking about persons causes problems for our relationships with other humans and not just, you know, non-human animals. So when we go to the South Asian tradition, human was like, we're animals. And in fact, you know, the tradition there begins with this insight that we live in a world where everything is determined by nature, Prakriti, or the gods, who are the gods of nature. And in this context, where's the room for freedom? Moksha, right? If everything is determined by some prior state of the universe, I'm being caused to have these experiences, right? I feel like I'm doing something, but really it's just like my brain firing, right? Where is the room for me? And this is something we share with dogs, cats, the earth, we're all part of this natural nexus. And their response was to say, well, if we can start working on ethics, dharma, we can create a space that isn't explained by external coercion, right? Mm-hmm. That's responsive to considerations of autonomy. And so there are lots of different positions in this tradition, but I think that's a kind of very common background. So in yoga, you start off with this interest in Ishvara, but that leads to is a solidarity with people, because we're all the same kind of thing with the same kind of interest. We need a world where the air is clean to breathe, but that's not a private matter. That's something for all of us, right? There's no way to have clean air, but only for me. And if it came to that, it would be a toxic world. Like, it would be so much worse if I had to carry a bubble around me than just having clean air, right? And so thinking about what we need as individuals with an interest in Ishvara leads us to appreciate how we have these common interests. And so as I take care of myself, I am actually taking care of others too. I don't have to think, oh, but what about other people? It's not even a dichotomy.
Is it for some though? I mean, based on their values?
For sure. But I think that comes from thinking about yourself not in terms of your interests as a person, but in terms of very idiosyncratic subjective considerations. And in the South Asian tradition, those kind of idiosyncratic subjective considerations were often characterized as selfish. They come not from a place of responsibility, but from attachment to experiences, things you've been through, to construct a narrative about yourself. And then if that's what you value, you can act in very selfish ways where others you're ignoring, but that happens outside of the realm of this kind of practice of responsibility, right? It happens because we're being irresponsible. My experiences are not really up to me. They're a function of all sorts of factors in the universe. And so for me to take that in and construct, in yoga is called asmita egotism, and construct this artificial sense of self, is actually for me to give up my autonomy to the world I live in, to internalize its system of oppression as part of my sense of self. And then, yeah, I will be completely selfish and will have to be reminded of others, but that's the cause.
So I just want to summarize this in a sentence and see if I got it.
Yeah.
True freedom is being responsible for yourself and others.
Well, if you're responsible for yourself, if we're talking about yoga, just worrying about yourself brings everybody else along, because you are one of a kind. There's a kind of thing, persons, and it's by virtue of being a person that you have interests. And so if you're going to protect the interests of what it is to be a person, you're going to create a space that's safe for everyone else too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just like in order for me to have clean water, I got to have clean water for everybody. In order for me to have clean air, it has to be for everybody. In order for me to have a safe streets or public, if it's really going to be safe, it has to be safe for everybody. I can create walls and bubbles, but that's actually not making my life safe. It's actually creating an illusion of safety within a wider context of danger. So really being concerned about myself gets myself as the responsible agent, gets me away from selfish thinking.
Beautiful. Are you someone that loves to be in tune with the cycles of nature? Well, there's something I've been wanting to sponsor for a long time, and I finally got my act together to do it. And that is that we would have community celebrations, reflections, meditations, where we come together every time there's a new moon and a full moon. This is something that really resonates with my heart, because every time I look into the sky and realize that we're getting close to a new moon or a full moon, I have this internal urge to kind of set some intentions and move forward in a new way. And I would like to share that with you, and I would like our community to kind of have that very natural marker in time every couple of weeks. So for the months of June, July, and August of 2024, this is going to be completely free. It's a beta test. We want to see how it goes. We want to see if you like it. We want to see if you show up. And basically, it will be on Zoom. We'll do about an hour of meditation, of education, of journaling, of connection. And we'll just have those markers in time every couple of weeks. And if it goes well, and we all want to continue after June, July, and August of 2024, we will continue. So we hope to see you there. You can look in the show notes for more information.
Okay. So that brings us to, as we think through what's happening in Israel and Gaza, how do you frame that? People aren't looking for the answer. They're looking for, the people I'm talking to are looking like, how do I even get my head around this and think through this?
Great. So I think that yoga provides us a lot of tools we need, because this is not the first time there's been suffering caused by one group of people and meted out to another group of people. It's not the first time that humans have done horrible things to each other, right? So this is not a kind of new circumstance. I do think it's hard for us to see the dimensions of oppression, because in a westernized world, we've normalized this linguistic sense of self, right? So we're encouraged to think in terms of ethno-linguistic identity. And if you look at the history of colonialism and oppression, that's actually where it comes from. It comes from groups thinking of themselves in terms of their ethno-linguistic identity, and then problematizing others who are not part of that ethno-linguistic identity. And so that, I think, is a piece that's difficult, especially for people in the West. If you grew up in a country with a history or a state with a history of colonization, that's just kind of how you live. You don't see it as a problem. You think that's just how, you know. The interesting thing about yoga is that it always presents us the right way to do things, and then it also provides us a diagnosis of what's going wrong. So it does both. The right way to think about any moral problem is in terms of what follows from your devotion to Ishvara. So if you're pure and content with that, you appreciate as a state of solidarity with people, and a person is the kind of thing that thrives given their own sovereignty and independence. And so then your state of devotion is really this radical state of solidarity with all people. In this state, look at what's going on. I can see myself engaged in solidarity with everyone who's suffering there, but I can also see that some people are not. So some people who are engaged in this mass suffering are not engaged in an act of solidarity with people. They're engaged rather with a very contingent sense of self in terms of ethno-linguistic identity. Now, it's not that we can't see examples of that on the Palestinian side, but if you look at what's going on now with respect to the justification for Israel's actions, it's all couched in terms of its right to exist. But what does that mean? Ethno-linguistic state, right? So that means then that the lives of Palestinians just don't matter as much, right? So the lives of every Israeli who was either killed or kidnapped on October 7th has this disproportionate value in the narrative relative to all the Palestinians who have been kidnapped or died. It's just remarkable, right? The scholars that I was listening to were saying that there was like a 20-to-1 ratio with respect to death, right? So for every Israeli who's died since the foundation of Israel, 20 Palestinians have died, right? So for you to normalize that as acceptable, you have to normalize the idea of somehow we shouldn't adopt this kind of blanket policy of solidarity with people. We should have this kind of ethno-linguistic prioritization. You know, and then there's all sorts of very weird discourse that follows from that, like, oh, well, Palestinians are just Arabs. They can go to another Arab state. There's like special, Israel has some type of special right to exist over and above. So, and a part of that is hard to understand if you don't understand the history of Zionism and Europe and the Holocaust and all of that. And many scholars have pointed out that a lot of that isn't actually all that friendly to Jews either. Like a lot of the early Zionists, quite anti-Semitic. You know, I think it's just really quite simple. Like when I look at this, I'm not trying to take sides. I want to be in a state of solidarity with everybody. Then I notice there's one group that doesn't. And they're the ones who are, you know, disproportionately powerful in this conflict. And the outcome is genocide. It's just hard to deny that. Now, the way you can deny that, the way it gets denied, is that people are very deferential to the rights of an ethno-linguistic group to survive, right? So then said, no, this is not genocide. They're just protecting themselves, right? But that's kind of neither here nor there. Like when you look at the UN law, that kind of the policy on genocide and what's involved in that, it's very easy to see that this is what's unfolding. And what stops us from simply calling it is that we just normalize the rights of a certain ethno-linguistic group and then kind of normalize the idea that people in the other camp just don't matter, right? Like they're just a kind of collateral damage.
Do you think that we're doing that because a lot of us are staying silent and just kind of not having sovereignty and not being devoted to Ishvara at this point? Are we doing that because of the guilt and shame over the Holocaust?
Well, okay, from a yogic perspective, there's like one, well, we have these samskaras. These are unconscious patterns that we've normalized, and usually they come from identifications with experiences that we've had, and then we institute them as ways of learning and dealing with new information. So that what ends up happening is we end up repeating the same patterns over and over again because we use these samskaras as our tools. And so I think that whenever you see people in a rut, even though the world is changing radically, they're proceeding as though nothing has changed. You can tell there's some scar, deep-seated some scars at play. You know, I think there are a lot of admirable people who are scared. It's also sometimes unclear what to do. There are lots of people I follow who are very vocal. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure. I think it provides an opportunity for people who sympathize with that view to feel like they have company. I'm not always sure it's actually changing anything. I do think if we feel safer exploring this pro-person position, it normalizes criticism. And that's the other interesting aspect of this, the way in which we're not supposed to engage in any criticism of Israel's activity. Like as a moral philosopher, we consider also any topic, even if you agree with what they're saying, we should be able to talk about it. But it's interesting how we're not. And there are repercussions for people who take a stand, especially who are critical of Zionism, there has been. So I think there might be historical some scars at work. The way oppression works is that there are punishment, like there's actual consequences for not going with the dominant story. And so, you know, I'm sure lots of people are worried about that too.
But can I say one of my samskaras, it's kind of vulnerable, but all my best friends are Jewish. And even though they're pretty much pro-Palestinian, which is what, you know, for the reasons you've outlined here, I am worried about anti-Semitism towards them because it's 400%. And I too feel like, is my little voice going to matter in the big picture?
Right.
And it does matter to them. It's not that we don't have these conversations, but going and screaming out on social media, they feel it's much more nuanced. They feel that it needs to be dealt with sensitivity and there's depth to the historical context and, you know, all of it. I don't want to be so boisterous.
Great. Yes.
Is that just my samskara and do I need to
get
over?
Well, you know what? I think this is just also part of the way oppression works, because when we internalize the system that we live in, we're scared to do things that's going to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. And one real consequence of having to do yogic work is that your relationships can get upset, right? I've lost some friends. I don't engage with some other friends because I can see they're very pro-Zionist and it would be a difficult conversation and kind of fruitless. And then I've had other friends who, like, I can see, given their some scars, how they're unreasonably sensitive to matters of Palestinian liberation. This is actually very normal. A lot of times, criticisms of anti-Semitism on university campuses. And it's interesting because you listen to Jewish professors who are sympathetic to the plight of Palestinians and say there's no anti-Semitism at these protests. But what you do find are things like people wearing keffiyehs. I had a friend who got upset at a sign that said, "Glory be to the martyrs," or something like that. And she thought it was glorifying terrorism. Like, that was her associated with the idea of martyr. But in Arabic, it's anyone who's died in unjustly. And so you could see how people, kind of given their own some scars, they're reacting. I do think the idea that this is kind of complicated is a function of all of that, the some scars that people bring. I don't think it's actually, because when you start kind of looking at it, well, either I can be in a position of solidarity with all people or not, right? It's a very simple choice. And then if you choose solidarity with all people, then you simply can't be motivated or moved by anything that tries to diminish or kind of accommodate oppression, right? And for sure, even people who might think are like on the right side of this issue, they've got a lot of issues to deal with. You know, what we can do, or what we have to do as practitioners of yoga, is not compromise, but also not deliberately alienate. So if I say something that triggers someone else's some scars, I haven't done anything wrong if what I've said is within the practice of devotion to Ishvara, right? So if I stand up for a gay person and there's a homophobe and they get upset, that's their problem. That's not my problem. And I think we just have to kind of know that when you're engaged in this practice of solidarity with people, because you're not actually against the person with the samskara, in the long run, they'll have an opportunity to see that you're not their enemy. You're actually on their side. But in the short run, it's difficult. They'll get upset. That's just the way protest works. It brings all of this to the surface, and then people have to deal with it. It's not easy or clean. It's messy and upsetting. But I think that's kind of what happens when we've just normalized it for so long, right? It's a bigger mess to deal with all of a sudden.
And when we say that we're pro-person, we are pro all of the Israeli people.
Yeah, that's it, right? We're not taking the view that we're only interested in a kind of group defined by some narrow sociological factor, right? Yeah, for sure. That position is nuanced, because we could be interested, committed to the independence of Israelis. From where I'm sitting in this practice, that means that I'm committed to, like, I also think that it's not in their interest to have an ethno-linguistic identity. It creates more problems than it's worth. Because if that's who you are, the whole world is a threat to you. You know, this is a very common Zionist trope that everybody hates Jews and stuff like that. My research into a lot of this started when I got interested in the difference between the experience of Jews in India and Europe. So Jews have been in India for 2,000 years. And everybody comments, oh, there's no anti-Semitism, as though that was weird. I'm like, no, that's normal. That should be our standard. And ask, why was anti-Semitism a thing in Europe? And many Arab Jews say it wasn't a problem in the Middle East until Zionism showed up. And so we kind of normalize this idea that everybody hates Jews, etc. It's not true. I think that when you start to look at, like, the history of anti-Semitism in Europe, it's because Europeans had this ethno-linguistic identity. Jews had this linguistic identity that was not European, Hebrew, and that rendered them a threat in their psychology. But South Asians didn't have that way of thinking about identity. So you could speak Hebrew and no one cared, right? It wasn't a threat. You know, we have to be, I think, far more historical. The problem is everybody kind of wakes up today and goes, this is the way it is. It's like, no, there's a history to what we're experiencing here.
And don't you think that that ethno-linguistic identity became even stronger when Hitler and the Nazis were basically killing them? So I would think that would be a time where you would recognize, I'm part of a group here that's being...
Great. So this is an event. My inspiration, I take a lot of inspiration from these remarkable anti-Zionist Jews. There's a ton of them out there who are very vocal, who have lost people in the Holocaust. And then I also know Zionists who also have family who died in the Holocaust. But I think what this shows us is that there's more than one lesson or more than one takeaway from this. And that depends a lot on kind of more basic ethical choice. I think that the anti-Zionist Jews that I learned from and follow, they diagnosed the problem as a moral failure. So yes, the Nazis had this ethno-linguistic identity that rendered all sorts of people targets, not just Jews, LGBTQ, disabled people. But the problem was that the Nazis were evil. Like, that was just an evil thing for them to insist on, that that was a requirement to be protected, that you had to be part of this group. And really, Jews deserve to be valued as people, right? Independently of like their ethno-linguistic identity. And then there's another kind of takeaway, which is, I think, the Klesha takeaway. So if Book 2, Sutra 3 potentially talks about, well, what happens when we start with avidya, ignorance? When we start with ignorance, we just buy our experiences as though there's no history to it, right? Mm-hmm. And then we construct this sense of self on the basis of that. And then we're only really happy when the world conforms to this, and we're upset when it doesn't, and that's Klesha. So when I look at what Zionists, well, some Zionists, not all Zionists, but Zionists who use the Holocaust as a kind of point of departure, I think what they've done is they've taken this horrible experience, it was a truly horrible experience, and constructed a sense of self on the basis of that horrible experience. And that horrible experience is that they were being persecuted because their ethno-linguistic identity was not valued.
Right.
So basically what they've done is they've taken what the Nazis were doing as though it teaches them something about themselves. And then the inference they draw from that is that, well, we need a space where our ethno-linguistic identity is supreme and safe. You know, the problem here is that you're learning from the wrong people, right? So that's the way colonization works. It works by this process of ignorance where we just buy our experiences as informing ourselves. And then we just carry on. We just replicate the abuse we suffer. We pass it down instead of disrupting it. And so I think the yogic alternatives say, well, people were making choices and they made the wrong choice. So it wasn't that Jews were the wrong ethno-linguistic identity. It was that Nazis were making a wrong anti-person choice, right? Mm-hmm. And so the proper response is to be pro-person. If people were pro-person, then Jews would have been spared the Holocaust. But because people weren't pro-person, they were willing to buy ethno-linguistic identity as a foundation of social order within the context of Europe, where Jews were a minority. The Jews were depicted as the problem, not the ethno-linguistic identity of the oppressors. So that seems like the more reasonable, because it doesn't allow for the replication of the problem. It also provides a moral criticism for a moral problem. And I think the Zionist response doesn't. It kind of just replicates what the oppressor does as though it's a solution.
It's just so ironic. We see it in so many groups that have been oppressed that take that exact blueprint and become oppressors.
Absolutely. So the Hindu right in South Asia, this is a theme. You could look at colonialism and oppression. People everywhere, they've got a choice about how they deal with their experiences. And you can either take the yogic choice where you adopt this practice of devotion to Ishvara, and then you realize that you were wrong because the way you were treated was not on the basis of your interests as a person. And so the actual solution is to expand this devotion as sovereignty, create a public environment where people are free to explore their own independence, their own individuality. Or you could take all the stories the colonizers told about you, construct a sense of self, and then try and create a society on the basis of that, right? Like, so the British invented the idea of Hinduism. It's not South Asian. It's not Indian. Hindu is actually a Persian word. The British came to India and was like, you all have this religion. It's Hinduism. But that just means Indianism. So they just kind of created this thing overnight. But then if you take this in as part of your sense of self, then you think, Oh, well, the problem was our Indianism was not being respected. So we have to construct a society around this ethno-linguistic identity. And then people who are not part of this, they're the problem, right? So then all of a sudden, India's got this huge Islamophobia problem. It has problems dealing with diversity. This is not kind of an indigenous South Asian way of doing things, but it's a maladaptive response to oppression. Book two, sutra three, if you want to look at
it. So is the solution to all that we've been talking about is to let go of our attachment to these identifications?
Well, we need something positive too. So you could just let go of the identifications, but you wouldn't necessarily be creating a just environment for yourself.
Abhyasa vairagyam.
Yeah. So like, for instance, I think one difference between Buddhism and yoga is that Buddhism would really stress letting go of these attachments, but it really wouldn't have any kind of alternate moral and political framework for us to participate in. And so one of the things I point out is you can look at Buddhist jurisdictions and they shamefully often have all sorts of histories of oppression and violence, whether it's Sri Lanka or Burma or in China, that is simply letting go and detaching. You might need to do that for some things, but that in and of itself is not a positive solution. There are other weird problems with Buddhism, like monastic practices. You need someone to fund you to have a monastery. Yeah. And so that often involves making friends with oppressive powers.
You have but to have yoga, powerful have friends to let
yeah,
go.
Yeah, for sure. You need them. Otherwise, how are you going to get your robes and how are you going to hang out in your monastery, right? But in yoga, we have a positive practice, which is Isha Pranidhana, devotion to Isha, and then we practice those essential traits. And then if we don't understand what that looks like or how that should go about, the eight limbs are an upaya, a remedy to help us kind of reset our practice. And that's why we start with yama. And the first thing is ahimsa. So then we have to disrupt the systemic harm and then participate in the facts, the satya of people not being deprived what they need, asteya, personal boundaries, respected brahmacharya, and then no colonialism or appropriating aparigraha. So that's kind of the baseline. And then it's within that context we can start focusing on a more personal practice.
And so as we get close to closing up here, I think so many people are frozen thinking, what can I personally do about this?
Yeah.
Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, for sure. I think that if you stop worrying about external events and how you should respond and simply put your energy into this practice of devotion to Ishra, and then you have to challenge yourself to overcome old patterns, that's the tapas, and then you have to also kind of make room to really self-determine your own values, swadhyaya. What happens is that fear that was holding you back from being more public and doing things that can help shift starts to disappear, because you're no longer structuring your life around trying to accommodate what you experience for fear of getting in trouble. Your energy is really going into yourself, which needs a lot of repair and care. And then as you do that, you will just start to find opportunities and resources to shift how we relate to each other publicly, because that's really the key factor that will make a difference, right? So these protests that have been going on campuses, like what they do is they force this issue out onto the surface, and then it's harder for people to hide. That's how all these social justice protest movements work. And, you know, that's just the ahimsa part. Like the less we're worried about accommodating and the more we're really there for ourselves, the easier it is for us to stand up and do the right thing. It's not even a choice. You're just like, I need to do this for me, because otherwise I'm living under fear and oppression and I'm accommodating everybody else and their preferences, right? And I'm not, and then what about me? And so then at some point you're like, oh, maybe I'll just make a little reel. I'll tell people about that. So it's not as though I haven't had those worries and fears, but like as a practitioner, I've been just working through them. It's not that I didn't think I did post earlier too, but I was always thinking, what is it that I can do that will help? And that was always exactly the same question of how can I help myself? Because if you've got these issues, others have issues too, right? Because it's the same external environment that we're all internalizing. And so then as you start to work through these, you actually show people alternatives, but you have to be willing to do that work yourself. And so for me, I spend a lot of time not posting because I'm spending a lot of time thinking about all these
Right.
things, but
I feel shame that it's taking me so long to get clarity. Well,
it's
it's not that I don't have
hard.
clarity, get clarity about what I should do.
Well, that's a harder thing. I think it just becomes the fog disappears when you can just focus on your practice. But that doesn't seem obvious. I remember after October 7th, it didn't seem obvious. I just kept watching the news in horror that things weren't getting better. They were getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And like, with
Continuously.
no kind of like on the trajectory, it's like, this is just getting exponentially worse.
You kept
And then you're taking all
hoping.
of this in, and then you're looking at the way people are acting and behaving as though this is the way things are supposed to fold. It's very weird, right? It's a lot to process. You just go back to your practice, and it really gives you the strength to not try and people please, right? I think. And you realize that there are lots of other people going through the same suffering as you know, in positions of relative safety, but feeling so helpless to make a difference, and then also nervous to even try. It is a weird problem to have because, like, there are no bombs falling on our heads. And yet, you know, here we are kind of often feeling paralyzed by kind of the indecision or the worry. Yeah.
That paralysis, I think, also comes from just thinking that the governments are going to do what they want. The U.S. government, Netanyahu,
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
they've got a plan. They're doing this. And I'm such a little tiny person that probably doesn't
Right.
make any difference.
For sure.
But I love what you said about when we can work through this through our yoga practice, we do it for us.
Yeah. It's not charity. You're not trying to be a martyr. You need to do this for yourself to be a free individual. Otherwise, you are just going to live under this impression as though it's okay. And you can't allow that for yourself. It's like either I can be free or I can be live in a prison. Like when you put it that way, the choice is kind of obvious.
Well, thank you for walking us through this today, Sham. I really hope that people will just listen to this and take into consideration what you've outlined for us as our work ahead of us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, the
Any last
conversation.
thoughts of wisdom that you want to share before we close up?
Well, I do think people think of philosophy as this kind of superfluous, not necessary. Why do you need it? And I think not caring about philosophy and the philosophy of yoga leads us to these places where we feel we lack resources. So I would really recommend people to take some time to think about learning about the philosophy of yoga because it's a remarkable resource to fall back on. But this was the way the practice began. It wasn't in yoga studios or on mat. The practice began with people thinking about these very issues of like, how do I deal with the world that's oppressive? And what room is there for me? And what are my options in this circumstance?
And I think a good place to start that study is with your book that has just come out in April 2024, Yoga, Anti-Colonial Philosophy, an Action-Focused Guide to Practice, which is published by Singing Dragon.
That's right.
And then do you also have courses? I'm on your website here,
Oh, yeah, for sure.
www.yogaphilosophy.com.
That's right. I have lots of courses. I have paid courses. I have lots of free courses. So if you want to just kind of get an introduction, you could take some of the free courses. I offer entry-level courses. The entry-level course for yoga practitioners I would recommend is Five Limbs. Yoga Sutra Essentials for Practice. That's further down on the page. But I also offer 100-hour certification programs. I offer a level one yoga philosophy certification and a level two. And yeah, so there's just a lot. There's a lot to learn. You know, I'm trying to make this accessible. The book does come with the free course, so there's that too. If you do purchase the book, you have that. These are some other free courses on my
Thank
page.
you for putting all of that together in addition to your full-time day job. It's pretty amazing how
Thank
much
you.
you're able to offer. So,
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And I'm sure we'll get feedback on all that's been said here, and I'll be sure to pass that along.
Take care, Amy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I am so grateful for Sham kind of walking us through the yogic perspective on this. And I'm sure this may have been a hard message for some people to hear, and maybe you completely disagree with it. And I think a big part of what we're doing with the podcast here is having the courage to have these discussions. What I'm seeing out there is that we are scared to even talk to one another about this for fear of, I don't know what, losing friends, losing family, losing jobs, losing, you know, who knows what could happen as we decide to speak out about this. And then when you combine that with, well, what is my little voice going to do anyway? Is it going to make a difference to the US government and to the Netanyahu government and Hamas? Like, it won't matter. So why should I lose some friends or family members or opportunities over something that will not make a difference? I can see how a lot of us have kind of gotten into that cycle. And I think what I heard Sham saying is, we are not speaking our truth to make something happen out there, other than maybe bring awareness, which is always a good thing, to get people talking. We are doing it because inside of us, we need to stay true to our values and our ethics and our morals. And we need to basically do it so that we stay clean within ourselves, because we are pro people. People on all sides of the issue, everyone involved, wanting this to come to a close, wanting a ceasefire, wanting to not see anyone else be hurt or killed or abused or tortured. We are pro-human, and it's okay to speak out and say, I want this to come to a close, and I'm ready for this genocide to be over. And I think that's okay to say. So I feel like this conversation has moved my needle a little bit. I've talked to other people in the past about this and how I can work through it. And I felt like I just got shamed, honestly, privately and publicly, when I had those vulnerable discussions as I was trying to work through it with myself. And that shaming didn't feel like it actually helped me work through anything. And it didn't feel good. It now had another layer to try to work through on top of my original confusion and avidya. Whereas this conversation is just about each person being sovereign. And what do we mean by that? We mean that in getting clarity within ourselves that we love other people and we want to take care of all people. That's what clarity of self is. That it's okay to say that out loud, and that there is nothing wrong with that, calling this what it is. So I guess each of us has some reflection to do, some tapas, svadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhana. And I welcome you into that process with me, and hopefully we can pray for a ceasefire to happen very, very soon, and for this to be over, and for each one of us to have grown in this experience and maybe be closer to a place where we're willing to call out the oppressors, or willing to say, no, that's not okay, that my personal safety is intertwined with other humans. And if it's not okay for me, it's not okay for them. I'm willing to put myself on the line for this. All right. Thanks everyone for listening, and I wish you well, and we will talk soon. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour each week. We're building a community here, and we'd love to hear your ideas about how you would like to build more community with us. Feel free to email us at welcome@theoptimalstate.com and give us your ideas on ways that we could be of service to you and build more community. We'd love to hear from you. Again, welcome@theoptimalstate. All right. Have a great day. We'll see you soon. A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel,
senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.